All right, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. My name is Ricky Ellison. I am the founder and chairman of the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. I've been involved in missile defense since 1980 as a college student, introduced to it by Ronald Reagan's National Security Advisor at that time, and Dr. Teller. We've progressed, obviously, over the last 37 years. And in 2002, when our nation withdrew from the ABM Treaty to enable us to put forward missile defense capability to defend our nation, we formed our organization because of the lack of education and the bitterness on divisiveness on the political spectrum on this issue. So we have been formed in our whole mission, and we sincerely believe that the more missile defense capability in the world, the safer our world is. And we've been on a very pure mission, nonpartisan, to push and advocate for more missile defense everywhere we can. Today, we are going to discuss the current capabilities that we have in the arena to defend against the North Korean ballistic threat today. This is not a discussion on solutions or policy or operations. It's a discussion on what our tax dollars have done over the last 37 years to get to a point where we have real, tested, proven capability defending 300 million people in the United States, defending 120 million people in Japan, and defending 80 million people in Korea today. It is obviously relevant with all options that are on the table that this is the absolute core capability that you have to enable everything that the world, the United Nations, our country, Korea, Japan, are going to look to do to try and change the situation. Missile defense is clear and needed. Today, we brought together for you, I think, the best people in the world that can speak to this issue of capability, reliability, confidence in the systems. So we have the privilege of having a speaker that was in command in June of the Korean Peninsula in its air and missile defense capability. We also have a speaker that is the three head of operations, was the three, for the Pacific Combatant Commander for all of the Pacific. And we have a presenter that develops, tests the systems to go to the warfighter. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to have each of them spend about 10 to 15 minutes on a presentation on the capabilities. And then we'll open it up for questions at the end of the last speaker. All right, so we're going to start off with Colonel Mark Holler. Mark Holler was the commander of the 35th ADA Brigade, which has two Patriot battalions and coordinates with the Korean Air Defense Brigades, Air Force Brigades there, and is the advisor to the AOC in Korea for the missile defense capability for Korea. We've spent a lot of visits there. We've had a great relationship in helping that Korean relationship as a one team, one fight with missile defense. Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Ellison, Ricky Ellison. I appreciate it. I'm honored to speak here today about missile defense capabilities in Korea to address the North Korean ballistic missile threat as well as their emerging nuclear threat. I must state up front that while I am on active duty as an Army colonel, what I present to you today are my opinions. I won't discuss Army policy or get into classified realm, obviously. I did recently complete a two-year tour of duty in Korea, where I served as the brigade commander for the Army's ballistic missile defense capability in Korea, which I believe you stated, two Patriot battalions. We had some short-range capability as well, and we brought that into Korea over the last several months. While I was in Korea, I was also dual-hatted as the Deputy Area Air Defense Commander. And in that role, it was my responsibility to advise senior Army and Air Force commanders on all aspects of ground-based BMD operations. And I did that, I performed that function on a daily basis. And also in that role, as a brigade commander and as the Deputy Air Defense Commander, I worked very closely with our Korean counterparts in the execution of that mission. I believe it's appropriate to start this conversation with an overview of what I think we all realize is a real and present threat from North Korea and the development of their ballistic missile systems and also the nuclear threat. It is something that I face daily while maintaining our brigade's fight the night readiness and missile defense and working and being closely with our South Korean counterparts in the same effort. So the scope of my contributions to this panel is really going to be from that perspective, an on-the-ground commander executing the BMD fight for a two-year period. I left command on the 9th of June this year, so fairly recent. I think it's probably right to start the conversation off with just make sure that we have a foundational understanding of what is the driving North Korean actions. I believe that there's two primary strategic objectives. First off is the survival of the regime in North Korea. Obviously, they're not in a great economic position, especially if they look south across the DMZ and see the prosperity that's going on in South Korea and really all around the rest of the region that they're not part of. And then the other one, I believe, is the ultimate goal of their dictator to reunite Korea under Pyongyang control. So I think it's, as we look at this problem set, it's important for us to frame it that the ballistic missile development, the nuclear weapons development are just our tools to achieve these two strategic objectives. So, most of us are aware that North Korea, for the past several decades, they have developed and operationally fueled short range and even medium range ballistic missiles that can target the population centers in both South Korea and Japan. And that's a pretty developed, robust capability they've had for some time now. So in response to this threat that's been out there for some time, the United States has deployed the Patriot capability, forward stationed Patriot capability, deployed and forward stationed Aegis capability with our partners in the region to help deter or mitigate this threat. And then it's also important to understand that both our regional partners there, South Korea and Japan, have also invested heavily in the development of their own ballistic missile defense capabilities to include their indigenous Patriot and Aegis capability. So what's changed recently? Definitely during the 2 years while I was in Korea, we saw that really it started with the change of the regime under the current dictator, Kim Jong-un. We call him KJU for short. His reign began December 2011, and since that, we've seen an accelerated research and development of a new class of ballistic missiles and the intermediate ballistic missile extended ranges over the previous medium range ballistic missiles, and then we've also seen the development of the ICBM, or the intercontinental ballistic missile. And these specifically designed to target U.S. assets in Guam, Alaska, Hawaii, and then also, from his own word, the continental United States. And then, as you look at this new class, it's something we have to pay attention to is kind of the advances that we've seen. Things like solid fuel, which gives them increased responsiveness should they decide to attack. Track versus wheeled missile transport, which gives them increased mobility. They're no longer relegated to some of the terrain. And they expand the survivability and mobility of their systems. And then we've also seen the beginnings of a submarine launch capability, and they're striving very hard to develop that capability. And if you look at if you look at North Koreans development of the nuclear weapons, it's a very similar situation. Vastly accelerated research and development under their leader, Kim Jong-un. So in the reign of his father, we had two nuclear detonations in 2006 and 2009. And then since KJU's been in charge in the last 4 years, he's had four tests of detonations of nuclear weapons. Each one of those progressively higher explosive yields. And as North Korea announced this latest test, this last test being a hydrogen bomb or a thermonuclear explosion, which factually is we believe had a much higher yield than previous explosions based on the geological magnitude detection problem test. And then the final two capabilities, as you bring these two capabilities that they're working hard to advance in very rapidly here recently, the last two pieces of the puzzle that they're trying to pull together and they're working towards aggressively are the miniaturization of the nuclear weapon to fit inside the warhead or a ballistic missile, as well as a reliable reentry capability for that warhead to reenter, especially for those longer range, intermediate range ICBM that are coming in exo-atmosphere and work on that capability to survive that reentry. So there's a basic kind of overview of the threat and really the question is, what have we been doing and what are we doing to mitigate or to address this increasing threat? So, I believe it's extremely important, while the focus is on the homeland, I think we need to also, again, coming from Korea and being a commander that was set forward stationed there, to understand and mitigate the nuclear threat against our homeland starts with the U.S. and the allied BMD forces in places in the Pacific theater, places like Korea and Japan. These missile defense forces that we have forward deployed, they provide the foundation for strategic options. Number one, they protect our forward-based forces, and also our forward population centers. They enable the introduction of follow-on forces. So we have to start putting more capability into the theater to address the threat. Those are absolutely enabled by the protection provided by the assets at this forward basis. And then probably most importantly, they enable, by doing those first two things, they deter, but they also enable decisive operations if that's required. So in sum, I would say they provide strategic decision space for the president. They provide strategic decision space for the heads of state of our alliance partners, as well as the senior military commanders, both U.S. and alliance partners in the region. And they also, by keeping those systems forward, keeping them ready, keeping them updated and modernized, it also sends a very strong message of our commitment to the security and safety of our allies in the region. So in Korea, two very recent land-based BMD efforts that I like to talk about is Patriot modernization there, and then also the introduction of THAAD into the terminal high altitude area defense. So the Brigade I Commanded was the very first U.S. Patriot force to complete what is the most significant software and hardware modernization of the Patriot weapon system since the 1990s. And we just completed that effort, 8-month-long effort. During that upgrade to again software and hardware, we upgraded the radars, fire control systems, we upgraded the launchers. So we now have that Patriot force. It's forward deployed. We have increased reliability, and we've extended the range and lethality of the Patriot system. It is the most modern advanced Patriot system in the world that's currently forward deployed in Korea. It also capitalizes on the increased capabilities of our new interceptor, which is called the MSE, or Missile Segment Enhancement Interceptor. And then the software upgrades also support increased interoperability with other BMD systems like that. And really what was most exciting about our modernization effort is, and this was a depot level modernization effort, where you actually brought systems into a large building and tore them down to nothing and basically rebuilt them with new components. And we did this in a forward station location while maintaining all of our fight tonight readiness mission requirements. Yeah. First time it's ever been done in the Army. Truly remarkable feat. The Army was able to do this by sending additional Patriot personnel and equipment to theater to kind of stand in for the units to be kind of rotated them into the modernization process. It was truly amazing to them. And I was proud to be part of that effort. I think it's also very important to note that our allies in the region are also contributing significant amounts of their defense dollars to modernize and upgrade their own B&B system to include their Patriot and their Aegis. So, you know, we truly have great partners in that effort. And then THAAD, you know, being being brought into Korea this year, tremendous additional capability to help support the U.S. and allies effort there. THAAD offers a tremendous capability with kind of a much wider range, and when you layer that with the Patriot weapon system, it really enables a lot of flexibility and options for the commander and prosecuting the B&B fight. So that was a very significant force. And just the last thing I'll state here is what's really important to understand is that the ballistic missile defense is not a stovepipe operation. It relies on other military functions to be successful. And probably the one that I would highlight the most is intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets. Or we call them ISR. They are supremely important in supporting and enabling the ballistic missile defense mission. And that's whether it's a national asset, a theater asset, or even a tactical asset, whether it's space-based, land-based, sea-based, or air-based type sensor, they all contribute to that necessary ability to answer information requirements on the threat. So we can make sure that we're we understand the disposition of what's going on with the threats, so we can be adequately watched. So that is my opening remarks. And, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Great job. Our next speaker is just recently retired, PACOM J3. He is the combatant commander. We have, as you know, I think 7 combatant commanders around the world. Combatant Commander Admiral Harris at PACOM. This is part of his command and this problem and this issue. Mark was his senior advisor on missile defense. Retired Admiral Mark Montgomery is probably one of the most brilliant minds on missile defense that our nation has. He started years and years ago, but we first met when he was in UCOM handling that mission, and has been the go-to source on operation of that capability as it continues to be fielded better than, I think, most people. So, ladies and gentlemen, retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery.
Thanks, sir. Thanks, sorry about that. And just one quick correction, 9 combatant commands growing to 10, 5 functional. But I was very fortunate to be both PACOM and UCOM, two of the more ballistic missile relevant combatant commands. I'd first start by saying up front, I think over the past 10 years, PACOM, enabled by the Department of Defense and specifically Missile Defense Agency, but also by congressional budgeting, has built an effective active defense and does remain postured to defend the U.S. homeland allies and U.S. forces in the field, U.S. homeland, our U.S. allies, and U.S. forces in the field from the current North Korean threat we're seeing. And I think that's a strong commendation of the effort that was made over the last 5 to 7 years and in the aggressive manner in which we've addressed the growing threats as we see them. I do think lately we're facing some new threats, both in North Korea and potentially with a near-peer adversary like the People's Republic of China, and I'll talk a little bit about those. But I'd also say, that the Colonel hit it hard, that we have worked to move a lot of forces into the theater over the last 24 months, whether they're ships or THAAD systems, and I'll talk about that in some detail too. So a very active theater with a lot of opportunities, but a lot of challenges. At the end, I'll talk about the two biggest challenges I see facing us. Generally speaking, our PACOM strategy has been to forward station integrated air missile defense sensors and weapon systems in the Pacific, because we don't believe we'll have the time to get those forces forward in a crisis. The crisis framework, particularly for North Korea, exceeds the amount of time it takes to either air deliver a THAAD or Patriot system or have a ship transit from Pearl Harbor, San Diego, or Washington, or Bremerton to Northeast Asia. So realistically, we have to be forward stationed. In that regard, the Navy's worked to send 3 of its latest Baseline 9, Ballistic Missile Defense Baseline 5.0 destroyers into the theater, Barry and Benfold are there, and I expect Milius will be there within the year, if not sooner, with home port ships. So these 3 ships will be permanently forward stationed in Fukushima, Japan. A majority of our Baseline 9 5.0 systems on the front line in Northeast Asia to help our allies and partners. Additionally, we've modernized the Patriot systems both in Korea and in Japan because of the U.S. systems in both those countries, and we've forward deployed THAAD to both Guam and Korea. So our 2 permanent forward station spots will be in Northeast Asia. This is a significant commitment by the United States and these forces. It has a positive aspect to it, which is that you don't need a 3-for-1 rotation of either THAAD batteries, Patriot battalions, or Navy ships. You instead achieve a much higher level of operational tempo with a smaller number of assets forward. So that's been our strategy over the last 10 years of missile defense, and more broadly over 40 years in our forces, when we look at forward station forces in Japan and Korea, which have maintained relatively constant while we had drawdowns in Europe over the same time frame. So, and a clear indication of a commitment to the broad defense of Northeast Asia and very specifically the ballistic missile defense of the United States, Korea, Japan, and our forces in the field. I also think we've made some good investments in resiliency, building passive defense capabilities, whether it's hardening or making things more expeditionary. But this is a constant investment. As your adversary builds more and better systems, you know, passive defense can be a very expensive game when you play along with it. Not that Johnny will talk about active defense, but I don't think he'd call active defense cheap. So missile defense is an expensive game, but we need to protect critical nodes either through replication or redundancy, duplication of those nodes, or through having a rapid expeditionary capability. I think the other critical element of success over the last 10 years has been the building of the partnerships, and I know the Colonel referred to it in Korea. I mean, if you look at Korea and Japan, they're the 2 most capable ballistic missile defense allies we have in the world, whether it's ground-based or ship-based. The number of Patriot batteries that these two countries have is 2 to 3 times the number of batteries we have in that country. So they have put down their money against our money to build the ballistic missile defense systems that broadly defend our forces in the field along with their populations. Sometimes subtlety is missed. That these are countries that, in addition to the grants they give us within their country, which is a whole other issue about, you know, for construction and military construction and operations of forces in their country, they put significant percentages of their defense budget into the missile defense, the broad air and ballistic missile defense of the AOR, which includes our forces. In addition, the Japanese are the only country that's built a full-up sensor plus shooter ballistic missile defense capability with their Kongo class, the four Kongo class destroyers. They have a commitment to modernize two more and build two more new ones. So they're going to have almost double their maritime capability over the next 5 years. They're also looking at both Aegis Ashore and/or THAAD as a system inside their country to improve that. So clear, significant investments that, when brought together in an integrated operational environment with us, which is how we operate forward, both in Korea and in Japan, helps defend our forces in the field, gives us early warning of attacks against either the homeland or U.S. territories in the Western Pacific. So clearly, the strength of these two countries' investments contributes broadly to our own regional homeland defense. And the final thing I'll mention on that is that we are glad to see that the General Security Military Information Agreement, or JSOMIA, between the two is going to pull all three of us together in tighter trilateral exercises. When I was at PACOM, we conducted in 2016 three Pacific Dragon-like activities. Pacific Dragon was the pro name, the operational name for it, but there were a series of exercises that tested our ability to link air defense information to each other. And it's a significant step on the way to having a broad integrated warning system about attacks. And that's going to be critical because, as we've seen in the last few launches by North Korea, Japan can often be the victim or the target or the intended target for deterrence purposes. So I think that to continue to work on that JSOMIA, to continue to work on integrated link exercises, is going to, again, further push this. And there's a third country in the region, Australia, that's also been looking at ballistic missile defense. We work closely with them. And as part of our broad work together, under approved under the Taiwan Relations Act, the military exchanges, we do work with Taiwan on security, including exercise observations and discussing operational concepts to include integrated air missile defense. So really, it's the area we discuss ballistic missile defense with our allies as our highest end warfighting integration. And so that work over the last improvements over the last 3 to 5 years, and broadly with the Japanese investments over the last 10 to 15 years, has paid off with a better coalition system. Yeah. And I think the final thing I'll mention about the successes we've had is, before we talk about a little bit of the challenges, is the work with MDA for the potential options on medium-range discrimination radar in Hawaii to combat specific North Korean ICBM threats to that state. And I'll leave it to MDA or during the question and answer period to discuss that. But I think we have a capable system today with the ground-based missile defense. We've demonstrated that. We've demonstrated it in computers, and we've demonstrated with live weapons. But what we're thinking about now is how are we ready 3 to 5 years from now, and how are we ready 5 to 10 years from now if this problem continues. So I think the MDA's decision-making over the last 24 months of that has gotten us to the right answer. If I can talk about some of the challenges, I'd say looking forward, you're going to say 5 to 10 years from now, what did we have to think about today to be ready that in 5 to 10 years? I'd say the first is that we have to redefine the threat is not ballistic missile defense, but broadly defensive fires. And that's across three areas. One is the air-breathing threat, which is the short-range air defense that Colonel spoke to, but also And probably this applies more to a country like a near peer adversary, such as Russia or China, is the issue of of land attack cruise missiles and anti-ship cruise missiles. So that's the air-breathing threat. Then you have to think about the hypersonic threat, and then you have to think about the ballistic missile threat. And if I could take them in reverse order, I'd say the ballistic missile threat, we have really worked hard on it. It's the MRBM, IRBM, ICBM. MDA is a 25-year effort that has resulted in the right capabilities. And it's just a question of, are we willing to make the investment in capacity? Are we willing to assess what the capacity is necessary to deal with an adversary? Are we willing to make those investments? But I think in the ballistic missile, we're in the best place. In the hypersonics, we're in an unusual place where we are a signatory to the INF Treaty, and the Chinese are not. And Vice Chairman and Joint Chiefs General Salvo has discussed whether or not he thinks Russia is adhering to the INF, but I think he's fairly negative in his assessment of that. So we're basically in a two-country treaty that limits us significantly, and the other country in the treaty is not adhering to it. And it means it has to limit us with China. Well, I'd say of the Chinese, the broad array of Chinese ground-based systems that face our forces, over 90% would be non-compliant with the INF. So over 90% of weapons are weapons we limit ourselves from building. This is probably not how you handle an adversary that thinks hard about counterinvention strategy and appears to build a military that generally targets your air and naval systems, is to self-limit your development and production. So I think air-breathing assets, ballistic missile, we've done the good investments. Hypersonic, we really haven't gotten into the right position on this yet because of self-limitation. And then finally, air-breathing, I think it's a question of capacity. We have the technologies. We do it out at sea with SM-2 missiles, air defensive strike groups and such. We can bring those kind of systems and shorter range systems like our ESSM and close-in weapon systems. We can work with the Army to build the ground-based systems. The challenge there, I think, is really a service challenge where defending, say, ships out at sea, I think the Navy looks around and says, who's going to defend these ships out at sea? And at the end of the 10-second pause, you probably realize the Navy's going to defend these ships at sea. So the Navy has a problem, and the Navy is charged with fixing it, and the Navy will spend the money to do it. And when the Air Force looks around and says, boy, we have a real land attack cruise missile threat posed at us, their solution is going to be an Army solution. And so I think it just becomes harder for them. They're a very challenging, difficult, expensive problem for the Air Force. It needs to be solved by an Army. And I just think it's going to be one of those things where the Joint Force has to work their way through to ensure they have great capabilities and building the capacity necessary to defend our forces out there. But against any near-peer adversary, whether it be Russia or China, there's a significant land attack cruise missile threat. And the Navy, an anti-ship cruise missile threat. The Navy's working hard on anti-ship cruise missiles. They have a good capability and a large capacity. And whether or not it's enough is a discussion for a different realm. But definitely on the ground-based side, we need a lot of work. So that's, to me, the biggest challenge over the next 5 to 10 years, defensive fires. How do we get at all three of those? Because if we leave one alone, the adversary will concentrate on that. You can be sure of it. And because of the openness of our budgeting cycle, they'll know what we left alone. So, we're really going to have to get it all. And then the second thing I'd say, so broadly defense fires, second I'd say is linking together all our architecture. And that, it's one of these things where you build, like if you build two brand new cars and you have them out there, you want to race them, but they don't drive on the same gas. You're not going to have a race out there because you can't get two different complete systems out there. What we really need to do is have fully integrated. We need to build the integration, whether the link systems in. We have to bake it in at the beginning of the service work. In other words, services have to be mandated to build into the broader link. And I just think there's too many systems that come up that MDA has to really do somersaults to pull that system into the broader missile defense architecture that we've built already. So I just think continue to emphasize that from the ground up, that almost every system, and this can be a 2-mile short-range air defense system around a base, or it can be a 2,000-mile missile defense intercept. you want to have a constant architecture across that, because it's not that the 2 mile, the 2,000 mile integrates with it, but the 2 mile integrates with the 10 mile, the 10 mile integrates with the 50 mile, the 50 mile integrates with 200 mile, 200 mile integrates with the 2,000 mile. So you can't have a break in there. If you have a break in there, that there's going to be an operational seam that the adversary can drive through. So you really have to have broad architectures that are truly joined across all three services, and then are available to the critical partners. If a partner's willing to buy the Congo class, then we need to be in a position to give that country full access to the link. And the same with Korea, the same with any other ally who's committed to working with us in a defended area. So I think working on defensifiers and working on the links that bring together the link system, the link architecture that brings together those systems is the two big missile defense issues we need to work over the next few years, so that 5 to 10 years from now, people can sit in this room and say, yep, we can handle this threat from North Korea, as you've heard all three of us say today. That's all I have, Ricky.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you. Our next speaker represents Lieutenant General Sam Greaves at the Missile Defense Agency. He also is the program manager for the Aegis BMD systems. And those systems today have the most capacity the U.S. has out and about in the fields. Rama Wolf has been a developer of that SM-3 system, and the new SM-3 Block 2A that's forthcoming is one of his pride and joys, I believe. And he's here to give you a perspective on the development and reliability, testing, and confidence of the systems he has to build for the warfight.
Thanks, John. Ricky. Okay, so what I'd like to do is take a couple of minutes and kind of tie together from what you heard about the threat and what you've heard from a COCOM perspective on what they're looking for, and kind of talk to you a few minutes about what we do as a material provider to counter that threat and give the combatant commanders and the services capability to do that. You know, I'd like to reiterate, as we've heard and we all know, right, North Korea continues to develop. They continue to test. They continue to make incredible progress, as we've seen just in the last couple of months. So what MDA is continuing to do is we're continuing to develop and field systems that can counter that threat, both today and both in the future, as you've heard. And we have work going on in every part of the Missile Defense Agency in every system that we've got today as part to counter that threat and to make sure that we have an underlayment. We talk about layered defense. And you've heard that it's not just about homeland, it's about regional as well. And so the Missile Defense Agency looks at both of those and looks at how we can bring a layer of defense to the combatant commanders to make sure that we meet that. So what I'd like to do is talk to you a couple of minutes about what testing have we done recently that gives us confidence that today, based on that threat, we have the capability to counter it. And if you look at since December, the agency has performed 7 intercept tests in addition to multiple ground tests and other things to prove that capability. And as part of every one of those tests, you heard where we talk about the integration. How do I bring things new into the BMDS architecture? So every one of these tests include the sensors that we need to be able to both see it and to communicate to the rest of the architecture, both where the threat is at, what the threat is, and where we need to go after it, as well as the command and control, what we call the C2BMC, across the entire BMDS to tie all that together. So let me talk a little bit about, Mark just talked a little bit about protection of the sea, right? In December, and then again here in August, we tested what we call sea-based terminal. And so we have proven through 2 extremely successful tests that we have with an SM-6 off an Aegis destroyer, we have Indo-atmospheric engagement capability to protect critical assets at sea and ashore along the shoreline. Both of those were with an SM-6, what we call an SM-6 Dual 1. Both of those proved the capability to intercept one of those threat missiles once it re-enters going after one of our critical at-sea assets. Incredibly successful, incredibly important, because we can now tell the Navy with confidence that they have a capability that they can set to sea and they can protect their critical assets while they're out there. From an Essent 3 Block 2A perspective, which Ricky mentioned, I am very proud of that. That is a cooperative development with the Japanese, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But we've done two critical flight tests of that capability, both in February and in June. In February, we had the first ever intercept with that particular Essent 3 Block 2A. Obviously, our allies, Japan, were there with us when we did that. It was the first attempt we made at an intercept. It was extremely successful, and it allowed us to continue to finish up with development so that we can transition to production. In June, we had SFTMO2. Unfortunately, we did not get all the way to endgame where we could consummate the intercept, but I will tell you that we learned a lot. We got a lot of data. We learned a lot about the system, which, again, gave us the confidence that we are on the right path and we will continue on with that development program and get that into production. So extremely successful. In May, we had FTG-15, which was a GBI test, where we tested for the first time the three-stage C2 booster and the CE Block 1 enhanced kill vehicle, a successful intercept against the first time we've ever gone against an ICBM class threat. Again, incredibly important to show the warfighter, to show the American public, to show our allies, and to show our adversary that the capability that we've got is good capability and it works. In July, we had what we called FTT-18, which was a THAAD test. That was the first intercept with a THAAD of an IRBM. Again, incredibly successful. Again, proving that we had capability in a regional defense posture with layered defense of an IRBM. And then here in July also, we performed what we call FET-01, which was, again, a THAAD test. It was against the target, and it was really meant to collect data so that we could continue to figure out how we want to take the THAAD system and how we can get advanced algorithms, we can get advanced processing into the system to continue to make that system better. So, you know, I think all of these tests, when you think about it, right, that is hitting a ballistic missile, you know, hitting a bullet with a bullet in space is incredibly difficult. But if you look, 7 times we've done it, we continue to show we've got the capability. And we continue to show both the American people, we continue to show our allies, and as importantly, we continue to show our adversary that we know how to do this, and when we need to use it, it will work. So incredibly important. You know, we're going to continue to look at this, and we're going to continue to look at the entire MBA portfolio to meet the combatant commander's requirements, to look at the threat. And so what I'd like to do is kind of talk about what are MBA's 3 priorities that we've laid out to go about that. And so the first priorities, we're going to continue to focus on how do we take the current systems that we've got today, and how do we continue to make sure the reliability is where it needs to be? How do we get the reliability better? And so we will do that by looking at, you know, we're looking at the GBI. We're looking at Aegis BMD and that system. I just talked to you about collecting data for THAAD on how we were going to go forward with that. We are looking for GBI at what we call the redesigned kill vehicle. That will give us, again, more reliability, easier to produce, something that will give us what we need. And then, of course, all of that, we will continue to support all of the systems that we've got, whether it be forward deployed, THAAD, Aegis, whether it be Homeland Defense and GBI, we will continue to support all of those systems as we move forward. The second major area is increasing engagement capability and capacity. You heard Mark talk a little bit about that, right? How do we go do that? We will continue to look at and build out the sensor architecture. Incredibly important, right? I mean, we've got shooters. I just talked to you about the tests that we did to prove those shooters. But as important is we've got to be able to see where it's coming from. We've got to be able to make sure we understand what it is so when we communicate to those shooters, it's right. And so we will continue to look at building out that sensor architecture across the entire BMDS. We will continue to work towards, and we will succeed in delivering 44 GBIs to our missile fields by the end of this year. We will continue to look at multiple object kill vehicle and what that brings to the system, as well as looking at how we do discrimination improvements as the adversary continues to mature, continues to develop. We need to continue to stay ahead of that and make sure that we can actually discriminate and go after what really is what we call a lethal object all of the time. from a Navy perspective and from an Aegis BMD perspective, we're going to continue to modernize our destroyers. Aegis Baseline 9 right now, which is the most capable Aegis baseline that we've ever had, integrated air and missile defense, where for the first time I can go after ballistic missile targets and I can go after air breathers both at the same time, incredibly important. We will introduce the SM-3 Block 2A from a capability perspective. We will continue to procure 1Bs from a capacity perspective. And then we are working with the Navy as they are in development of their advanced SPY-6 solid-state radar, which is just an incredible radar for capability. We continue to work with them as they work to deploy that in their new construction destroyers in the future. We will be right lockstep with them to make sure that when that radar gets developed and it gets fielded, all of the BMD capability that we can take from that will be there as well. We'll continue on with LRDR, again, from a discrimination and from a being able to see perspective. And we will continue to work with our allied partners, okay, particularly with South Korea, we talked about that, and Japan. The 2A program, I think personally, is a great, great success. If you look at what Japan has brought, one-third of the development of that program has been paid for by Japan. Their industrial base has developed the motors that will go on the SM-3 Block 2A, and they have been an incredible partner through all of this, and we've continued to prove that capability, and we are in the throes of transitioning to production so that we can get that into production and we can deliver it. From an interceptor perspective, we will continue to focus on delivering more THAADs, delivering more SM-3 rounds. We expect to get a full production decision on the SM-3 Block 1B this year to be able to get to an FY18 production. And then, as I said, we'll transition to production on the 2A as well. And then the third major area that MDA is focused on is addressing the advanced threat. As we know, there's critical capabilities that we've got to look at to defend things such as hypersonic glides, to defend some of these countermeasures, which we know that our adversary is producing. We've got to be able to get advanced discrimination to pick those out, and we've got to be able to also address the capacity issues so that we can defeat larger inventories as countries like North Korea continue to produce and field. So we're going to continue down the path of looking at all of this. We are committed to doing that. We work very closely with the warfighter, with folks that are telling us what the threat is doing, and we will continue to do that to invest in all of these capabilities. Finally, I'd like to leave you with one thought, okay? Everyone should have the confidence today that we have the strongest defense possible to counter any of these ballistic missile threats that we've got. But we are going to continue to work to make it even stronger as we move forward. And that is the commitment, and I think we're meeting that today.
Thank you, John. Thank you. You guys had a great presentation. We'd like to open it up for your questions. If you can just state your name and the organization who you represent to start, and we'll just do as many as we can. Go ahead, sir.
Retired Vice Admiral Fumioda from Japan Maritime Training Force. You are just talking about the THAAD, the Aegis, and PAC-3, but I'm very interested about the airborne laser, high power. The reason why is we have to shut down the boost phase because they are threatening us for the EMP, electromagnetic pulse, and also the recent Quantum 12 is only single warhead, but Quantum 14 be a multiple re-entry vehicle, so the sooner the better. So I know the United States Ballistic Missile Defense Office is developing the high-power laser, airborne laser, but nobody mentioned about that. So,
thank you, Admiral. Mark, could you just talk about the operation feasibility of such a weapon, and if John can talk about where you're going with directed energy in your development?
Obviously, if you want to get something in the boost phase, that's what the best and only options other than a active defense to remove a launcher before it launched. Feasibly, it depends on the country. It depends on whether you can get safe battle space for your airborne laser to be in. So this won't work for every country. I think you're specifically thinking about North Korea, and that might be a more feasible operational perspective. But I would say from our point, I know we worry a little bit about multiple reentry. I'd also say if you can shoot something down to the mid-course, if you can handle that problem as well. So something like an airborne, a high-powered airborne laser, is of value. It is not necessarily a required solution, but it's certainly of it would be part of a, you know, in an integrated family of defense systems, it would have a role to play. So I would just say that we've never stipulated that we must have it. What we stipulated is that there is value in it. I pass it to the technical side.
Sure. Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So MDA continues to look at lasers and directed energy. What I would tell you is there's a couple of challenges. The first challenge is, how do you scale a directed energy weapon from kilowatts to megawatts to get the amount of power that you need to get it in something like boost phase? And then the second thing is, how do you get a platform that can take that and carry it? So MDA has a very structured approach, right, where we are looking at how do we get that scaling so that we can get to the capability that we would need, and we will continue that as we move forward. But those are really the two key challenges that we're looking at.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dan Mosley from James. Sort of a broader question for Admiral Wolf. You spoke about the need for better discrimination and better sensor capability, but not much about space-based. So are there efforts underway or consideration underway to get better space-based tracking and avert the death, kind of the holy grail there?
Yeah, so that's exactly what I was talking about when I kind of said, right, you know, this being able to detect from a sensor perspective. We are looking across the spectrum to include space-based to figure out how do we get the best capability to be able to see it, to be able to communicate that we've seen it, that birth to death, so that we can track it all the way from the beginning to the end. So that is certainly part of the overall strategy as we look across the entire sensor architecture and what capabilities we can bring.
Give like a time frame, I guess, for when
something
like that might be?
So what I'd like to do is, because I'm not the real space expert, right? What I'd like to do is take that as a lookup, and if I can get you with our PO, Chris, we'll get you the answer to that based on what you're looking for. Okay?
Thank you.
Yes.
It's an emerging capability. It's something that they're working on. But I tell you, most importantly, though, is that we have a credible current capability to defeat that threat in Korea right now. The U.S. has a short-range capability there, both sensor and shooter. And then the South Koreans have a very robust capability against that type of threat. So it is something that all of our crews, to include our Patriot crews, train for, and they're ready to detect it, track it, and defeat it. And as the North Korea continues to try to develop that capability, I'm pretty comfortable to stay well ahead of that.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I have a question for Colonel Waller. Sam Anderson in Rao's office. Now that the THAAD batteries are in place in Songju, what do you see as the civil military engagement challenges and the force protection challenges, and I guess sustainment challenges too, because the protests continue, and you've got disrupted supply routes, along with known Korean infiltration of South Korean protest movements. And what do you see as a sustainment force protection challenges there?
It is a sensitive topic with the populace there. A lot of it's kind of politically related with pressure from third country nations that they've placed on Korea. China's placed a lot of pressure on South Korea because of the presence of that, a lot of economic pressure that they've so that's been a burden to them. I mean, that's something that the population is very familiar with. And there's, but what I can tell you is that you know, we have the commitment of the South Korean government for the deployment of that system. I was there and witnessed some of the challenges with the local population. But I worked closely with and worked with the local police department, the national police, and the Rock Army was also there to help protect and secure, you know, that area as well. And they, so there's really a lot of, it's a challenge, but it's also a great opportunity for continued partnership and collaboration in the people. But I think over time, that situation will ease and resolve itself. Had a very similar situation with Patriot. You know, if you look back several years ago, where there was some angst amongst the population that was worked through over time in partnership with our ROC allies. So I've got a few questions.
Yes, sir. Dominic Kramer with Congressman Joe Courtney. I wonder if either of you gentlemen could talk about kind of the strategic implications of testing. Obviously, we've seen North Korea ramp up and conduct much more frequent tests because they don't fear public failure, whereas I think the U.S. are you going to come after money for Congress, and we have to say that you have some demonstrated capability, but maybe there are strategic implications to show that we have unsuccessful tests. So how do you balance?
So let me start off by saying, so every test that we do is truly realistic and representative, unless we're trying to prove a specific development capability that's not part of the overall system. So we do some of those tests. You don't always see them as part of flight tests, okay? Because the way that we architect the system is that we will do incremental improvements. We'll do ground testing, okay? We do a lot of ground testing. We do a lot of integration testing before we ever get to a flight test. Flight tests are extremely expensive, okay? So I think it's our responsibility to make sure that if we develop the capability, we do that in the most cost-effective way. And the flight test is really at the end to prove the capability that we've developed through modeling and simulation, through hardware in the loop tests. So it is a systems engineering process to get to that point.
I'd answer the last two questions. First, under force protection, I'd say I think Kim Jong-un's testing program is probably the number one thing that will drive the population into the right place over time, because at some point you have to assess that what he's doing is a threat to your day-to-day life. The second one, what I'd add on from the North Korean perspective is that they don't have an oversight mechanism of this, right? So they're not really worried, and this is their national... I don't even think we could put a equivalent priority. No. I mean, even the moon, you know, the moon program in the 1960s doesn't approach the fever and the percentage of discretionary budget that's applied by the North Koreans to this effort, and to the point that it actually affects their conventional readiness and capability when they're so committed to this effort. So, if you're that committed, you're not going to go through an MDA 3-month review process after each, no bomb failure. Otherwise, we'd be about 18 launches behind where we are now in the North Korean movement this year. So I just think it's a different focus. There's the oversight's provided by the person who's making the decisions, and as a result, they're pressing forward.
But for the U.S., are there strategic implications if we do a flight test and it shows that it maybe fails, and that would only increase their opportunity or confidence, or weaken the confidence of our partners?
I think this on the partners. I think we do enough tests, and we're open and transparent with them. I mean, the Japanese and the Koreans, routinely our allies observe tests. If they're involved in the investment of it, they observe them at a very detailed level. And as a result, I think that transparency allows for a system. We don't say, none of our systems have a PK of 4.0, right? And we recognize that. And some of those things that bite you and make your probability of kill 0.9 show up in a test. And in fact, a robust testing program that solves problems is going to probably, you know, we know will long-term overall raise the probability of kill for all your weapon systems. So I think we're very comfortable with a transparent open system.
And we recognize that no Koreans aren't looking to convince anyone about the, from their point of view, a PK at 0.1 is okay if they fire 10. You know, whereas we don't want to convince that.
Jason of Senator Sullivan.
Hey, Jason with Dan Sullivan's office. The Senate just authorized the second largest GDI capacity increase in history. Given the levers of capability, capacity, and reliability, if you had a single dollar to spend extra in the MDA budget, which of those levers would you put it into? And specifically, what would you put it into in that lever?
Well, that's a pretty solid question. I will tell you, I would have to say it depends, okay? But you know, as we've talked about, if you look at the architecture, right, and you look, you're absolutely right, right? 44 GBIs by the end of this year, okay? Incredibly important to get at just that. But again, I think if you look at the MDA priority, it really is to understand when I invest another dollar for reliability or for making sure that we can get that capacity. Capacity comes in a lot of flavors, right? You know, being able to have a sensor network that and a discrimination network that helps me reduce the number of interceptors that I might need to launch against any particular threat, that in and of itself becomes a capacity growth, right? So that's why building out the sensor architecture is incredibly important to be able to do that. But of course, capacity, when we talk about regional, also important. So we look at that and figure out where that right investment is based on where we're at with all the programs.
I'll take that one and say that the reality is none of us in our job should answer that question without a lot of guidance from the Hill and from the executive branch of, is our national strategy to shoot down every ballistic missile in our country? Potentially over a country. Well, that would massively bias us towards a GBI investment if the answer was yes in everything, no first launch investments, right? The next question would be, to what degree do you hold certain countries to be adversaries? Next question would be, how much initial pain are you willing to accept on a first strike, conventional first strike by an adversary? So you answer four or five questions like that, then you go to MDA, you have to describe the effect you want, but to do that, you have to give them the strategic footprint that they're going to operate in. So it's a very hard question. You know, if you gave me a dollar at the end of a budget cycle, that's when that question is a great question, because at that point you have five things in production, you know, five programs in run. You know which three can absorb an extra dollar and which one has the most cooldown demand. So that's probably how I give my extra dollar normally. But if you want to sit back and say, really, how should we make missile defense investments? You have to set up a strategic framework in which you're operating missile defense. And there's a broad difference between thinking that the only ones you have to shoot down the complete inventory are North Korea or future Iran or China and Russia.
Don't you also have to balance that with the timeline and the rate that the threat is also progressing?
No, I agree completely. In other words, what's your adversary up to? I will say that North Korea he's adjusting one of our rheostats for us. There's no doubt about that. I mean, no other, even other, you know, rogue states don't move the rheostat like he moves the rheostat. And don't align the country completely to this mission like he's aligned it to this mission.
Great answer, Mark.
Thank you. My name is Sato Daily. My question is to Admiral Ball on the E-Sato system, which Japan is buying. Japan is buying that system, I think maybe with and what kind of improvement or new capabilities will we see with that?
So we continue to work very closely with Japan on just that question, and ultimately the decision on where those systems go, what interceptors go in that system is up to Japan. We are providing all the data to give them all the analysis that shows what the capabilities will be. But I will tell you, much like we have in Europe today with EPAA and the Aegis Ashore we have there, Aegis Ashore and the SM-3 brings incredible capability to the country of Japan, and we will continue to support any requests that we get to make sure that as the final decision is made, we can help provide that capability.
I'd say one thing on Agents of Shore too. I mean, that if they go for Agents of Shore or that or both, what is providing Japan is that integrated defense that's critical. You need to have the most inexpensive as possible bolt out of the blue defense. So it's a fight tonight defense, as we said. You want to keep that cheap because you have to pay for it 365 days a year. So a ground-based system gives you that because it's just maintained there as a fixed startup cost, but then it's just the cost of maintaining the people on the station. The ships then give you the surge capability to give you a broad defensive depth, a better sensor architecture that allows you to use less missiles in the defense of your systems. So you want this fight tonight ground-based system that gets you defended for the first 6 or 8 hours. Then the Japanese destroyers would come out of Sasebo and Maizuru and go up and do their mission. And so this integrated defense really was the next logical step for Prime Minister Abe in thinking about how to provide a long-term integrated defense for his country against a growing North Korean threat. So I think it's wise, and whatever system he went with, or the Japanese ended up going with, is their choice. And as you said, what weapons they put inside of it are their choice. But historically, you can see from what we've done in Europe what a logical platform and laydown looks like for a bolt out of the blue attack.
Any other questions? Well, this has been a great discussion. I think we've covered the whole breadth of it, that we can all walk away knowing that we have great confidence in the current capabilities and addressing the needs that we need to go forward with to defend our country from North Korea. So thank you very much, Mark and Johnny, for presenting and being open and having a great dialogue with the audience. Thank you very much.